Hi there. Welcome to another edition of the Romance Program. I'm volunteer Jeannie host for Sun Sounds. My story this hour is from True Confessions magazine. It's called Choosing Between My Husband and My Father. Here's a story. The sun caught the blade of the knife, making it wink with the brightness of diamonds. Brad, that's a knife. What's wrong with you? I screamed. My husband's face was a contorted mask of rage and hatred. How dare you defy me? I told you that he's trying to ruin your life. I won't let him ruin mine, he shouted and threw the knife. I watched in horror as it bounced and arced from the sink to the floor, where three of our cats circled his feet, hoping for a handout. The sound of scurrying paws combined with the dull thud of the knife as it impaled itself into the linoleum of the kitchen floor gave me a brief feeling of relief. When my husband stooped to pull the blade from the floor, I spun around and grabbed the back of the kitchen chair. I licked my upper lip. The beads of sweat accumulated there tasted salty sweet. The deep bass of Brad's voice seemed to fill the room. I felt his words strike and bounce against my eardrums. You're not a taxi service. Do you know how hard I have to work to put gas in the car? Do you know what a tank of gas costs? That psycho calls and you go running. I'm out of here. My husband hissed out the words. I can't stand it anymore. I'm gone. Please, Brad, I sobbed, don't leave me. What will you leaving me solve? Why are you hurting me? I'm stuck in the middle, you on one side and him on the other. I love you. Are you going to throw our marriage away? You love me? You have a funny way of showing it. His footsteps warned me of his approach. Sweat trickled down my back. I heard the unmistakable sound of a knife swishing through the air. The wood of the chair bit into my hands, and I sunk to my knees onto the floor. No, Brad, no! I could barely understand my own words. For the first time in my marriage, I was afraid for my life. Gripping the chair back more firmly, I pressed my head against the slats and waited to feel the cold steel of the knife bite into me. The booming of Brad's voice reduced me to loud, gulping sobs. I no longer tried to fight against his words. I wanted to make myself small, too small for him to notice me. I jumped when I heard the clatter of the knife hitting the stainless steel of the sink. I won't have it, Kyle, he shouted. Do you hear me? You will not run into town every time he decides. He needs attention. Let him call someone else. Let him call your brother. I felt the air swirl around me as he strode past. Still crouched on the floor, I didn't dare turn my head to see where he was going. For the moment, I was relieved to have him gone. The sound of the garage door opening and the roar of a motorcycle engine told me that he left the house. Unable to move, I waited until I heard the roar of the motorcycle growing softer as my husband raced away from me. Slowly, like an old woman, I pulled myself up off my knees. My entire body felt bruised, although the only blows I'd received were verbal. I walked to the sink and stared at the 12-inch blade of the carving knife resting there. Drawing a shaky breath, I reached for the coffee pot, poured myself a cup, pulled out a kitchen stool, sat down, and stared into the deep brown liquid, hoping to see the future. Instead, I smelled the heavy, sweet scent of lilacs and felt the warm breeze of late spring brush my cheek, and I saw my past. Charleston's beauty is breathtaking any time of the year, but in the spring, it's unequaled. Juggling the hot coffee and warm croissant I just purchased, I cast my eye over the tables clustered on the outdoor patio. Disappointed that none were empty, I walked off in the direction of the park, intending to enjoy my breakfast on a bench overlooking the water. I'd reached the first step when, out of the corner of my eye, I noticed a good-looking man push back his wrought iron chair and stand, detouring in his direction, intending to snag his soon-to-be empty table. I was startled when he pulled out the second chair and held it for me to sit. "Please, ma'am, I'd appreciate it if you'd join me." He bent from the waist almost as if he were bowing. Briefly, I wondered if he were going to dust off the seat as well. "I couldn't. I don't want to intrude. I want to watch the water. So much history here. I want to drink it in." I began to sidle away when a breeze blew my hair down into my face. Nearly blinded, I put my coffee down on the table to clear my vision. The man quickly reached for my plate and put it on the table next to my drink. "See? No imposition. Your breakfast looks as if it belongs." He stuck out a hand. "Brad Pierce, and I'm pleased to meet you." I've always been a sucker for men whose eyes crinkled at the corners when they smiled. Laughing, I took his hand in mine. "Kyle Stewart, thank you," or Kylie, that is, "thank you for rescuing me." He tucked the chair beneath me and returned to his seat across from me at the table. "That's what I do, Ms. Stewart, rescue damsels in distress. You know that this is a very unique place." I gazed out beyond the park to the sparkling blue waters of the harbor. I wasn't sure which was lovelier, the harbor view or the tall, well-built man sitting across from me. "Beautiful, yes, but why do you say unique?" "Well, it's where the Atlantic River is born." My cup paused midway to my mouth. "Excuse me? You're a visitor here, then?" he asked. Nodding, I said, "Yes, I came for the weekend." Seeing his eyebrows arch a silent question, I continued, "From Georgia." I took a sip of my coffee. "Are you from Charleston?" Brad shook his head. "No, Fort Jackson, at least for right now. I've just completed my second tour in Iraq, and I'm fixing to be a civilian again." He looked down at his plate and crumbled the last of his croissant. "Been offered a job in the private sector. I thought I'd take it." I looked out at the harbor again. "Why did you say what you said about the Atlantic?" Curiosity had the better of me. "Simple. Ask anyone here and they'll tell you this is the place where the Laura and Ashley Rivers meet to form the Atlantic." My head jerked up so quickly that I nearly choked on the bite of my pastry. When I saw his impish grin, I couldn't help myself. I began to laugh. It turned out that the job Brad accepted was in Atlanta. Within a month, he'd left the army and moved south. He assured me that even though he'd stayed in the reserves, a call up for him was unlikely given his rank, age, and years of service. My only response was to cross my fingers. We combined our households 6 months after we met and married a year after that. Our first year was blissful. Brad was everything I could hope for in a man and a mate. Sexy as all get out, he was still a gentleman, kind, tender, and loving. We agreed on nearly everything, and even when we differed, we seemed to find common ground. Although he'd been married before, he rarely mentioned his first wife. It surprised him that this was my first marriage. He referred to himself as my starter husband. Privately, I congratulated myself on waiting until I found the best. Over time, I learned some topics were off limits between us. Once, when I'd mentioned that I'd hiked Stone Mountain With the former boyfriend, Brad's temper flared. The outburst seemed so out of proportion to the statement that I resolved never to mention any prior connections that involved exes. I'd remained friends with most of them, and now, to avoid scenes, I gradually broke off contact with them. What bothered me most was my father and Brad's failure to get along. Frankly, I blamed my father, not my husband. After my mother died, my father relied on me as his social outlet. He spent weekends at my house and cat sitting when I wanted to travel, and he'd come to rely on my individual or undivided attention. Soon after I married, he informs Brad that his place in the pecking order was second and that my primary role was to be on call for Dad. Brad tolerated Dad after that, although he made it clear to me that while he understood my commitment to Dad, he preferred we keep our family contacts to a minimum. Except for the occasional ripple, all seemed calm in the Pierce Pond. Something changed in Brad with the announcement of the troop increase. At first, I thought he was worried about a recall. His temper would flare for no reason that I could determine. A question about where he was going, someone with a different point of view, a news story, even something as simple as seeing people on television making expensive purchases would cause him to explode. The outbursts passed quickly, but they seemed completely out of proportion. He'd even begun tailgating cars ahead of him if they didn't maintain the speed he wanted. His behavior was so uncharacteristic that I finally suggested he consider talking to someone about it. He exploded at the suggestion, shouting and calling me a psycho for even suggesting that he might be out of control. Confused and frightened, I resolved not to bring the subject up again. Then my father threatened suicide. Guilty and concerned, I raced over to his house and ended up taking him to the emergency room. When the doctors there assured me they were going to admit him for his own protection, I returned home. Brad was uncompromising. He was convinced that my father was using the threat to manipulate me into being more attentive. When the hospital called back and demanded that I return to be with my father through the check-in process for the psychiatric ward, Brad had a screaming fit. He'd calmed down, but I could feel his anger simmering just beneath the surface. He wanted me to call my brother in California and have him fly to Georgia and take over. I couldn't reason with him. He knew my brother hadn't seen my father in nearly 15 years. That particular morning, the phone rang. The hospital wanted to tell me that my father wanted me immediately. He needed glue for his dentures, and the hospital didn't stock any. As we sat down for breakfast, I'd shared my plans for the proposed trip with Brad. His reaction had me sitting at the table staring into my empty coffee cup and trying to figure out how I could resolve the situation without hurting my father, betraying myself, or losing my marriage. I rose to pour myself another cup of coffee. Standing at the kitchen window, I looked out at the rain-slicked streets. Brad was out there somewhere on his bike, his anger out of control. I felt as if the walls were closing in on me. I knew I was about to lose my father. He was so old and frail. In a strange way, I understood his desire to make his own decisions, even his final one. I bowed my head and prayed for strength and wisdom. The wisdom to know how to say goodbye to my father and not lose my husband as well. What, I wondered, am I supposed to do? How can I balance all the parts of my life and still be present for those I love so much? Bringing the coffee to my lips, I nearly choked when I heard the rattle of the side door opening. Brad was home. I'd been so lost in thought that I somehow missed the roar of the motorcycle racing up the driveway. The hairs on the back of my neck prickled, and I resolved not to do anything to upset him any further. I knew he'd have to leave soon. His motorcycle club had their meeting, and he was the treasurer. Meetings generally lasted 3 or 4 hours. That would give me plenty of time to take care of my father. What Brad didn't know couldn't hurt any of us. The kitchen door slammed open. "You still here?" I nodded and walked over to hug him. I couldn't condone his behavior, but I loved him. His body went rigid in my grasp. Ice particles felt as if they were piercing my heart. "I came to get my things. You can do what you want with your father." Dazed, the only thought in my mind was that he sounded as if he were growling. I'd read the descriptions in books of people who growled, and I'd always thought it a funny visualization. Now I knew they actually did it. Pulling my head back, I looked up into Brad's face. "What do you mean? Why are you leaving me?" "Leaving you? Oh, that's rich. Me leaving you. You made your choice." He carefully unwrapped my hands from his shoulders and placed them at my side. "You made the choice. You want to be with your psycho dad to jump every time he calls or does something stupid like this. Then there's no room for me in your life." "Brad," I tried to make my voice sound calm, but even I heard the edge of panic it had curling around my words. "You're throwing us away? I don't understand." Kylie, you made your choice." "What choice, Brad? What are you talking about? Where are you going? Why are you leaving?" I drew a shuddering sob so deep that it felt as if my stomach was coming up through my chest. "My father is a sick old man, Brad. I don't know if he'll come out of the hospital alive." "You should have seen him. He could hardly walk, Brad, and maybe I had no right to." "What the heck are you talking about? You jump to his tune. You take care of him. You do everything for him, and I get to bankroll it." "I don't think so." He threw out his hands, gesturing as he shouted, and caught me in the cheek. The sharp slap stung, and tears of pain sprang to my eyes. Brad reached out for me, whether to strike again or comfort, I wasn't sure. I pulled back and huddled in the corner. Standing his ground, my husband stared at me and then down at his own hand. "I didn't mean to hit you, Kylie," he mumbled that time instead of growling. Pressing myself further back, I watched. The pain in my heart grew, and finally I said, "Brad, don't you get it? I need you. I love you, and I need you to help me through this. I need you to be here for me." "I can't," he whispered. "I have to go. I can't be married to you and have to share you." Tears shone in his eyes as he looked up at me. "Why can't you see that?" I felt torn, ripped in tiny pieces. I did not understand what was going on. This was my father. He needed me. My big, tall, strong husband could manage to share me. I took a deep breath. I didn't know what else to do. "I'm not going into town," I said. My voice sounded weak and frail. "You don't want me to go, so I won't go." He put his hands on his hips and tilted his head, looking at me. "Yes, you will, as soon as I leave the house." He turned and walked off in the direction of our bedroom. I heard a scraping sound as he pulled his duffel bag down from the shelf, and then the sound of drawers opening and closing as he packed his bag to leave me. Still huddled into the corner, I watched my husband walk past me out the door without even a backward glance in my direction. My stomach did flip-flops when I heard the revving of his motorcycle. Staying true to my promise to Brad, I refuse to leave the house all that day. Where will he go? I wondered. He'll have to come home. I spent the day sitting in front of the picture window, clutching a cup of coffee that had long since gone cold. When it got too dark to see down the street, I rose and made my way to bed. Sometime around 4 in the morning, I got tired of staring at the ceiling and asking myself questions without answers. I climbed out of bed and dragged myself to the study. My heart actually felt broken. I knew I had to accept that Brad might not come back. Booting up the computer, I logged into our bank account to check our funds. With only one income, I had no room for error. As I thought, our grand total cash in the bank was less than $5,000. I checked the credit card statements for each of our accounts. Shocked, I realized we owed more than $40,000 on our credit cards. My stomach plummeted to my shoes. I knew Brad liked to shop and he had expensive taste, but I never thought we were that bad off. Brad handled our finances such as they were. The only bills I paid were the utilities and my personal card. I bit down so hard on the pencil in my mouth the eraser came off between my teeth. Unable to comprehend the extent of our debt or see a way I could pay it off in a reasonable amount of time, I felt a cold fear grip my stomach. Walking to the kitchen, I looked around our house, searching for something to sell. When the phone rang, I jumped. The caller ID showed a private number. My hand hovered over the receiver. I knew it had to be the hospital. How could I be so selfish? In my misery, I'd forgotten all about my father. Mrs. Pence? I couldn't help it. I winced at the name. Yes? You admitted your father 2 days ago. We need your permission to give him some additional treatment. The voice on the other end of the phone sounded guarded, as if the person wanted to get as much out of me as they could while offering nothing. I'm his health care surrogate and have his power of attorney. Can you tell me what kind of treatment and why? My palms were sweating so badly that I switched the phone from hand to hand, rubbing my hands down the front of my pajamas. We would like your permission to give him a shot of an antipsychotic medication. The woman cleared her throat, and I heard someone else prompting her in the background. The doctor says your father is catatonic. This is an attempt to bring him around. Of course, if the doctor thinks it will help. I'm on my way there right now, just as soon as I can get dressed. No, it's best if you don't come right now. The woman who called me had handed off the phone to someone else. Is this the doctor? Yes. Your father was so worried that he was causing trouble between you and your husband. I think if he comes out of this, it will upset him more to see you. He loves you very much. I nodded and hung up the phone. Feelings of failure washed over me. I couldn't decide what to do. I knew I had to go to work. I needed the money, but I didn't think I'd be able to concentrate. Not that day. I reached for the phone to call in sick when I heard the familiar roar of a motorcycle, followed by the rattle of the garage door opening. The door into the kitchen crashed against the countertop as my husband burst through it. He dropped his duffel bag on the floor and swept me into his arms. I have been such a lowlife. I'm so sorry, Kylie. I love you. I don't know why I did what I did. My body begged me to respond. My brain screamed caution, and deep in my heart, I felt a sliver of ice that wouldn't melt. How's your father? Brad held me back at arm's length. I felt his eyes piercing mine, as if he were trying to see into my thoughts. Catatonic. They used that word. The hospital just called They're trying some kind of a shot or another. As his look of concern, or at that, I felt my resolve crumble. I threw myself into his arms and sobbed. My heart felt as if it would break. Oh, Kylie, I've been such a louse. He ran his hands over my hair and stroked my back. I love you, baby. Don't give up on us. I nodded my head, but my heart still wouldn't lighten. Finally, I wiped my eyes and looked up into his. Brad, when I couldn't sleep last night, I looked at our bank stuff and our bills. Brad, how did we get so far in over our heads? His body stiffened beneath mine, and he pushed me away. It's nothing I can't take care of, he said through his tightly clenched teeth. So instead of missing me, you were trying to figure out how to empty the bank account. Is that it? Brad's voice was too quiet, almost a whisper. Nothing in our marriage, not even the knife incident, chilled me more than the tone of his voice. Who is this man? What's wrong? I'm sorry, Brad. I don't mean to question you. No, I just wanted to see where we stood. I thought you were gone for good. I pressed a hand over my mouth. I was babbling, and that wasn't the issue. My father was the issue, and it seemed Brad relented on that. Eyes like steel glared at me. I'm paying it off now, he smiled. Get dressed, and I'll take you to see your dad. I know you want to go, and I'm worried about your driving with so much on your mind. The hot water of the shower beat against my upturned face, washing away my tears. Though I was grateful that my husband seemed ready to accept my father, his volatile temperament frightened me. Brad dropped me off in front of the hospital and promised to come back for me in an hour. The drug treatment worked wonders, and my father was sitting up in bed, spooning up some soup. He looked tired and was clearly depressed, but he was functional. I sought out his psychiatrist to thank him. Dr. Pinella was in his office going over someone's chart when I knocked. He looked up at me, smiled, and beckoned me to the chair across from the desk. Something about him was calming and comforting. Mrs. Pierce, no, please call me Kylie, I responded. He tilted his head to one side and steepled his fingers, bringing them to his mouth. Okay, he nodded. Kylie, then. How are you holding up? I know there's some tension between your father and your husband. My intention was to smile and put the conversation back on my father. Instead, I found myself telling this man about Brad and what happened between us. Dr. Pinella leaned back in his chair and listened. The more he listened, the more I wanted to talk. Finally, I ran out of words. Realizing what I'd done, I felt my cheeks burn. I'm so sorry, doctor. I don't know what happened. I babble when I'm nervous. I folded my hands in my lap and concentrated on them as if I could find the answers to the questions of the universe there. I'm glad you told me, Kylie. It helps me when I can see the world my patients live in. But there's more to this than you may realize, Kylie. You told me your husband was in the service, and did 2 hours in a war zone. I nodded without looking at the doctor. 3, actually. He was in Desert Storm. Did your husband mention whether or not he ever got treatment for post-traumatic stress? I shook my head. Well, it would be irresponsible for me to diagnose someone who isn't my patient. However, I think that if you could encourage your husband to get some treatment, either from the VA or a referral from his regular doctor, it might help. What you're describing sounds like it might be post-traumatic stress. This is also recent, doctor. I managed to lift my head and look him in the eye. I don't think Brad will ever see a psychiatrist. Kylie, from what you told me, it's not recent. It's just escalated recently. There's a difference. You may be right, though. He may not be willing to seek help. Then what? If he won't get help, what do I do? I felt the intensity of Dr. Pinella's gaze on me. I could tell he wanted to offer me a solution. My hands groped the sides of the chair I sat in while I waited. Then you have to decide what you're going to do. This isn't going to get better, and it won't ever go away without treatment. It may ebb and flow based on what else is going on in his life, but he needs to get help. The doctor stood. Reaching forward, I took the hand he offered. I see what you mean, I said. I glanced at my watch and saw that I'd been with the doctor for nearly an hour. I popped in quickly to say goodbye to my father and was relieved to see he was sleeping. Not wanting to risk Brad's wrath, I raced down 6 flights of stairs to the lobby and barreled out the door. Brad sat in the car, parked at the curb, calmly reading a newspaper. He looked up and smiled when he saw me, got out of his car, came around, and opened the door. The person was my Brad. This person was my Brad, the man I fell in love with. When we got home, we sat down and had a long talk. This Brad I could deal with. He agreed to give up his credit cards and to discussing purchases with me. I agreed to work overtime to help pay off the extra charges caused by the interest. My father, no longer able to live on his own, moved to a nursing home. For the first month or so, Brad managed to come with me to visit him. No matter how often or how gently I tried to bring up the topic of post-traumatic stress, Brad wouldn't discuss it. I called Dr. Pinella and told him what was going on. He was encouraging, seemed happy for us, and asked me to keep in touch. Then he cautioned me again that while the symptoms could abate, they were unlikely to disappear without treatment. He also invited me to keep in touch and let me know that he was happy to take time to talk with me. No matter how hard I tried, the sliver of ice that seemed lodged in the center of my heart never melted. Sometimes I could forget it was there, but no matter how good things seemed, I felt as if my attention was always up. It wasn't a comfortable way to live. Still, I told myself that I loved my husband, and he was trying hard. Sometimes I would catch the muscle in his jaw working, a sure sign Brad was under strain and trying hard to please me. The day before Father's Day, I went to pick up a Father's Day gift. On impulse, I picked up one for Brad, too. I found a vintage G.I. Joe in Vietnam-era combat attire in an antique store. I remembered Brad talking about having one as a boy, and I thought it would be fun to bring back memories. I stopped at a fabric store and picked up some camouflage fabric to wrap it in, knowing he planned a motorcycle trip while I took my dad out to dinner. I stashed it in his saddlebag. Dad and I were at dinner when I heard the roar of the motorcycle pulling up outside the restaurant. I looked out the window, recognized Brad's bike, and saw him dismount. I froze when he stormed into the house and strode over to our table. His hand whipped out from under his jacket, and he threw the action figure on the table between my father and me. "What kind of a joke is this, Kylie? You giving me a doll. What are you trying to say?" I cringed when his hand snaked out and he picked up the action figure by its legs and ripped the head off, throwing it at me. He then turned and left the restaurant. My father started to get up and go after him. I managed to restrain him, and somehow we got through the meal. I tried to finish dinner and pretend that everything was all right. Brad was waiting for me when I got home. One look at his eyes, and I felt the tiny sliver of ice in my heart spread and encase the entire organ. No matter how hard I tried and how much I closed my eyes, this marriage was doomed if Brad didn't get help. Knowing how touchy he could be, I carefully closed the kitchen door behind me and set my purse quietly on the counter. Brad, I'm sorry if I offended you, I began. I wanted to give you back a piece of your childhood. I didn't mean anything more than that. He was out of his chair before I could step away from the door. His hand cracked into my jaw, lifting me off my feet and tossing me into the wall beyond. I didn't know that expression, seeing red, was true until that very second. A red haze broken by dancing black dots obscured my vision. I felt the warmth of unconsciousness overtake me as my husband reached for my shirt collar and pulled me up from the floor. He shook me. I saw his mouth moving, but I couldn't make out his words. My hair whipped my cheeks as my head bobbed back and forth on my neck. When I tried to defend myself, my limbs felt as if they were spaghetti. Finally, after an eternity, Brad opened his fist and I melted to the floor. I lay there for a long time. Brad didn't leave that time. I heard him in the living room. He turned the television to a science fiction movie. Occasionally, he'd walk over me to the refrigerator, and I'd hear the pop and hiss of a beer opening. When the sounds stopped and the lights were out, I cautiously lifted my head from the kitchen floor. My head hurt so badly that I didn't know if I could make myself stand upright. Fighting nausea, I managed to get to my car and drive away to a nearby motel. I was too embarrassed to face my friends. I vowed for divorce without ever going back home. When I saw Brad across the table in the judge's chambers, he held out his hand to me. I hid my hands behind my back and took my seat without saying a word to him. The judge asked each of us if the marriage was what he termed irretrievably broken. I couldn't believe it when Brad said that he wanted to try again. He looked me directly in the face and told me how sorry he was. I asked him if he'd gotten treatment. When he looked confused and told me he was fine, I knew I'd made the right choice. I couldn't risk being with him, no matter how good he still looked to me. I haven't remarried, but there's a wonderful man in my life now, one whose life is an open book. Maybe someday we'll change our status, but this suits me fine. Every day I thank God that I'm still alive. Okay, that's the end of that story, my first story. If you tuned in late, this is The Romance Show with volunteer Jeannie Yost for Sun Sounds. So now I'm going to read some features from True Love magazine. The first one is called How I Know I'm in Love, and this is just a little mini story where people ask, or they talk about how they're in love, and it might not be a love interest like a man or a woman. It might just be a father or brother or that. So anyway, how I know I'm in love. I was dancing in a local clogging group when I became very good friends with my future husband's sister. She noticed one night at practice that I was heartbroken over a recent breakup with my boyfriend. She asked me if I would like to meet one of her brothers. She showed me his senior picture from high school, but there was only one catch. I had to wait 2 weeks to meet him. He was on a hunting trip in Wyoming. He knew nothing about me until he arrived back home that Friday, 2 days earlier than he was expected. Trina and I were dancing at the local fair that Friday night. As we were sitting on the side of the stage, watching people come to watch our show, I noticed a tall, dark, and handsome guy walk in. I looked at Trina and she looked at me. "That's your brother," I said. "No, it's not," she said. Well, needless to say, it was her brother, and she had to call out all the steps of the dance to me that night. My mind had gone completely blank. Later that night, we rode some rides at the fair together. Both of us were very shy. He asked my parents if he could take me home. After we arrived at my house, he leaned over and kissed me. Then he asked me if I'd like to go out with him again sometime. I said yes. So we made a date for the following Friday. 1 week after our first date, we both said, "I love you." He bought me a dozen red roses, and that meant a lot to me. He graduated 2 years before me. I graduated on a Monday night, and that Friday night we were married. This June, we will celebrate our 15th year together. For us, it was love at first sight. And that was written by Jenny L. Powell from Georgia. So here's another little mini story and a feature from True Love magazine called The Life I Live. This was written by W.S. from Florida. My life now is very limited and what others might consider dull or even boring, but I'm much happier now than I've been in a very long time. I don't have a car at my disposal, and although I live on a bus line, I only venture as far as the convenience store across the street. I clean house, cook, read, and wait for my fiancé to come home from work in the afternoon. On weekends, we shop for groceries, washcloths, and do the incidentals that I can't do during the week. My man and I enjoy our time together, and we're grateful for it. I have the most wonderful man in the world, and you'll understand why we're so happy after you read my story. Until 8 months ago, I was a crack cocaine addict and a prostitute. As for the addict part, I will always be an addict, but now I'm a recovering addict. I was a well-educated, hardworking mother and grandmother until I tried crack in June of 1986. My life went completely downhill after that. I could tell you stories that would curl your hair. I've been raped and beaten and have been arrested more times than I can count. I barely escaped death after ingesting a large amount of drugs, but I didn't escape injury. I caused permanent damage to my heart and will have to be on medication for the rest of my life. When my fiancé met me a year and a half ago, he saw within me the person I once was. He fell in love with me and wanted to help me start a new life, but I had to wait until I was ready. 9 months ago, I decided I was ready to try. We live in the present now and look toward the future. We don't dwell on the past, but we know it's there and will occasionally bite us in the rear. We can deal with that because we have each other and we discuss our thoughts and feelings honestly. Any other man would be using my past against me. Some men would be afraid to leave me in their home alone or around cash or valuables. Not my man. The limits and restrictions I place on myself are self-imposed, and for my own protection, I know that I have everything I need at home and have no reason to go out. I never want to take the chance of being out alone and being recognized by one of my old dates. I would die of embarrassment if a cop who knew me thought I was up to no good and decided to stop me to check my ID, like they did so often once. I never want to run into anyone. I bought drugs from or get high with. As restricted as my life seems now, it beats the heck out of my old life. It's the best high I've ever had. Okay, that's the end of that little mini story, and I still have time to read some more mini stories. So this one is from True Confessions magazine, and it's the feature called My Man, written by Phyllis J. Cording from Indianapolis. Here's the little story. Going through two bad marriages and raising four children alone, I promised myself I would never get involved in another relationship. One day my car broke down, so I called my boss and asked if he would send someone to pick me up. And that's when it happened. He sent Bobby to pick me up. Bobby was handsome, very nice, and easy to talk to. For the first week, he picked me up and took me home in a company vehicle. One Friday, when he took me home, he asked if he could pick me up the following Monday in his personal vehicle. I told him that would be fine. There was something special about him, and it was as if a magnet was pulling us to one another. After 4 weeks, he proposed by telling me that he'd fallen in love with me and he wanted to take care of my 4 kids, the goldfish, and me. I didn't even have to think about it. A week later, we were married. That was 19 years ago. He helped me raise my children, and they all love him as much as I do. They even call him Dad. Our first granddaughter was born, and our daughter called my husband and said, "Dad, I've decided to name my daughter after you." Needless to say, our little Bobby is his pride and joy. We are still very deeply in love. He's my best friend, my lover, a father to my children, grandfather to my grandchildren, and I honestly believe that God sent him to take care of my children and me, because he has definitely been a blessing. Happy anniversary. Okay, that's the end of that little mini story, and now I have another one. It's from True Confessions Magazine, and it was written by Priscilla Mayo from Louisiana. It's called The Life I Live. Here's the story. I find myself extremely fortunate to have had wonderful neighbors willing to help my elderly mother and me after Hurricane Gustav's landfall. That's one thing I have to say about my small town of Lawtell. We all help each other out when we can. I honestly don't know what I would have done without any of them. After the storm was over, my neighbors and I were out assessing our damages, cleaning up our yards, and helping each other with the heavier limbs and branches. One gentleman used his chainsaw to cut and remove the heavier limbs from my yard. He was even nice enough to haul it away for me in his truck. Another gentleman finished removing a broken limb out of my trees without even being asked. Knowing I had no transportation, one good-hearted guy brought me some meals ready to eat, MRE, and 2 bags of ice to help out. I did have enough canned goods to last me the rest of the week, yet he willingly stood in those lines, long lines, for the MREs and the ice when he truly didn't have to. He just did it anyway. Still, others made it a priority to call every day to make sure my elderly mother and I were okay. They made sure we had enough food and kept us up to date on Lawtell's power situation, how many trucks they saw, who had power, and so on. It's amazing and heartwarming at the same time to see just how everyone pulled together during a time of crisis. Instead of just worrying about their own situation, they put it all aside to help other neighbors in need. It's a great feeling to know just how good small-town living can be. I don't think I'd ever want to live anywhere else in the world. I am truly blessed to call this small town my hometown. Like Dorothy says at the end of The Wizard of Oz, there's no place like home. Okay, well, that's the end of that story. I still have time. And I don't think I've ever read this feature before from True Confessions Magazine, but this is called True Confessions Phenomenal Woman. This one was written by Chandelier Foa from Washington, and it's called An Angel Kiss. Here's the story. My sister was always outgoing and fun, but when she was 6 years old, she was diagnosed with a very rare muscle and tissue cancer. She endured more shots, surgeries, pokes, and prods than any child should endure. She inspired her family, her friends, and her community. At the age of 7 and a half, she was told that she was in remission, but that didn't last long, and the cancer was back. Right before her 9th birthday, my sister became an honorary police officer and firefighter. That was her dream. Shortly after her 9th birthday, my sister knew that she didn't have much time left. One day she told me, When I die, I'm going to come down and give you lots of angels' kisses. I simply didn't want to think about her dying, but my sister passed away at home two weeks later. I was 13 years old, and I couldn't believe it. It was almost 4 years ago. Not a day goes by that I don't miss or think about my sister. But I know that she's in a better place. She truly was a phenomenal woman. This is an angel kiss for you. Okay, I'm going to end this romance program now with a romantic poem. This is from True Romance magazine. It was written by Dee McCollum, and it's called Bonus. Here's the poem. He stood before my desk, military straight in his uniform, sufficient in his new role. But his eyes were the same, large and brown. You don't forget the eyes. I wanted you to know that you were my first love, he said. I look for you in every girl I meet. In the teacher's lounge, talk turned to quitting. How violence and misfits, lack of backing from parents and principals, have ruined education for the learners. It was all true, of course, but it wasn't always so. My mind went to the second row, third seat, fifth grade, a boy with soulful eyes who turned an old maid into a goddess. And here's one more poem to finish out the hour for the romance program. This poem is from True Romance magazine, and it was written by Pearl Hoffman. It's called Love is a Many Splintered Thing. Here's the poem. He told her that he loved her, and he counted all the ways. He gave her gifts and flowers on all the important days. He brought her special delicacies from a chocolatier 20 miles out because she said she liked them, and that's what love's about. He listened to her intently. Each word was like a jewel. He knew how to start her fire and when to add more fuel. There was one matter that he chose simply not to mention. Why let his being married become an issue of contention? Okay, well, I think that is going to do it for this edition of the Romance Program. As always, thank you so much for listening. I so enjoyed reading to you all my stories, short stories, and poetry. And I will talk to you next week. In the meantime, have a great week. This has been Volunteer Jeannie Ost for The Romance Show. Take care. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.